I'm Sherry Tan from Pacific Lutheran University. I'm in the chemistry department, and what I'm going to talk about today is household hazardous chemicals. Welcome. A guy just walked in. Thank you very much. Menus about half to maybe two-thirds of the chemicals around the household, so you're going to have to be the representative here. I've titled this Home Safe Home, and it's a term that's lifted from a group in Seattle called the Washington Toxics Coalition, and I'll talk a little bit about them at the very end of the presentation. But they do a Home Safe Home tour every year or two where they take someone's home and have walking tour through it where people can look at, you know, the entire house, and they have cupboards labeled and a variety of displays of chemicals you might find around the home. And it's really a pretty nifty idea. And they're willing to let people use the idea to do a fundraiser, for instance, which is what they use it for. This session has two purposes. The first is to provide you with some information that might help you make some informed decisions as you purchase chemicals to use around your home, as well as use the chemicals. And the second is strategies for you to take back to your community. How many of you have household hazardous waste pickup days in your community? Couple?
Drop-off days.
Can you put household hazardous waste out in your recycling containers in a special container? Some communities are starting to do that, but I'm glad to see a lot of you have drop-off days. That's great. Most of you from Washington? Where are you from?
Minnesota.
California. Washington.
California.
The states that are the best are well represented here. Michigan, Minnesota, California, and Washington happen to be the states that have the best programs in place right now. And the other states are kind of beginning to catch up. California is really good when it comes to the Golden State Empire people in the Sacramento area. Well, why be concerned? Well, of course, there are human health issues with using chemicals around the household, pet health issues, possible damage to wildlife, of course, damage to plants, harm to beneficial insects, wastewater treatment plants, place where your sewage goes and gets treated before it goes into some body of water, aquatic systems, aquatic water systems, rivers, streams, as well as groundwater, our drinking water supply for much of us. And of course, if we dispose of them improperly, there's the cost of cleanup. So I hope one of those issues is the issue that grabs you and will be one to prompt you to act. In Seattle, in about 1979-1980, the city decided to determine what was in the wastewater coming to the sewage treatment plant and where the various materials were coming from. So they surveyed all the industries, and they surveyed all the businesses, and they surveyed a selection of homes. What they found was about a third of the toxic chemicals coming to the Seattle wastewater treatment plant were coming from homes and very small businesses. And that was a real surprise to them. And all of a sudden, the city of Seattle got real interested in funding a program to look at household hazardous waste that were going down the drain. And from there, programs grew because, of course, concern about what was going into landfills as well. It's estimated that something about the equivalent of 4 Exxon Valdezes in terms of oil go into the water every year by individual actions. It's probably a lot more than that, probably about 10 times that amount that gets dumped on land because of individual people's actions. So oil is certainly a very big concern. Okay, what kinds of compound chemicals do you have around the house? Well, lots and lots. Of course, there are various kinds of solvents, things for cleaning, solvents for cleaning, car parts, for instance. Some people keep gasoline around to clean car parts, which I'll mention is a very bad thing to do after a bit. Of course, paints, both latex-based paints and water-based paints. Lacquers, brush cleaners, and paint strippers. In terms of pesticides, of course, you automatically think of the thing you put on the roses or ant killer. But in addition, you have a lot of other pesticides around the home as well. Wood preservatives, slug bait, fertilizer that has weed killer in it, as well as various kinds of disinfectants. They're all kinds of pesticides, all specifically designed to kill living organisms. It's the definition of a pesticide. Household cleaners, which of course can include detergents, drain cleaners, shower scum removers. Tilex is one of the ones I like to pick on a lot. Spot removers. Auto products, of course you have motor oil, gasoline, batteries, antifreeze, various kinds of metal cleaners, which may well be phosphoric acid. And other products that include things like mercury-containing batteries, hobby products, which I'll talk a little bit about, art products, photography developing materials. So you have a lot of different kinds of chemicals around the home. Now there are basically three consumer decision points with chemicals around the home. Purchase, use, and disposal. The most important of these is the point of purchase, because that's where you're making the decision on use and disposal. And let's spend a little bit of time talking about purchase. Consider when you purchase something where it's ultimately gonna go. So, in doing so, you need to think about what the label says. Any of you label readers? You read the string of chemicals on the label? You know what they mean?
No.
Right. I'll make a confession. Most PhD chemists can't read the list of chemicals and know what a good share of them are or mean. The worst case was when I was in Australia a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. We were very concerned about something called Russell River fever, which, while not fatal, makes you wish you'd died. And it's carried by mosquitoes. The last thing we wanted was the students to get it when we were out in Russell River fever country. So we told the students to buy mosquito repellent. And people recommended this one called RID, which is dynamite. That stuff really works. Well, I brought it home and started trying to figure out what was in it. I still haven't figured out what was in that mosquito repellent. And on top of that, the next time I was back in Australia, it was labeled as carcinogenic and been removed from the market. So I felt real swift. Well, if you read the label, of course you know that the thing that's on the label first is the in largest amount in material. So in this Breck shampoo, for instance, we have water, ammonium lauryl sulfate, lauramide, DEA, etc., etc. About the fourth thing down is ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid. If you read the side of an Angel Food cake mix, about five or six items down, you'll find two of those same chemicals, the sodium lauryl or ammonium lauryl sulfate and the ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid. It's there for a purpose, to stabilize bones. Stabilizes foam in here, stabilizes foam in Angel Food cake mixes as well. Both of them are basically entirely harmless. But how do you know that when you read the label? Likewise, if you read the Aquanet label here, I wanted to find a can of spray deodorant, but all of us good environmentalists up here, no one had one, and I forgot to bring one along, but I did find a can of Aquanet. First thing is SD alcohol 40, followed by butane and propane, and then after that, a whole series of the things that make hairspray sticky. Now, I shouldn't say this in a room where there are people under 18, but butane and propane are both pretty flammable. If you take a spray can, and don't do this with hairspray, it's really flammable, take a spray can that says flammable on it and hold a match up about here, we'd have a flame about like so coming out of the can. At any rate, reading the label is real hard to do, but there's some key words to look at, and I'm going to come back and talk about those key words in just a minute. Size. Buy the size for the use you're going to put it to. Paint is a perfect example where a gallon costs about $2 more than a quart. But what happens to all your extra paint? Dries out, turns into a rock, and goes into a landfill, ultimately. So if you need a quart, buy a quart. Even though it seems like very little savings, in the long run, it means it's something that won't have to go to the landfill, won't have to go to a hazardous waste pickup day, and won't provide a potential hazard around your home. Purpose. Buy something for its intended purpose. Don't buy it for another purpose, and likewise don't use it for another purpose later on. So think about it. Is that a purpose you're likely to put the chemical to in the long run, or do you really need that chemical for that intended purpose? Aerosol and non-aerosol is an interesting issue. This, of course, is an aerosol in a non-refillable spray can. And we all assume they're bad, and indeed they are, for a variety of reasons. One, they provide a very fine mist, and that mist has particles in it, droplets in it, that are very, very small, and can actually travel down into your lungs quite nicely. So these are bad because of the small size of the mist, the fine droplets and the particles. They also don't hold very much. Think about this giant bottle is 9 ounces. This bottle, hard to compare the volumes, but this bottle is about 8 ounces. So you don't get very much in a spray can for the size of the can. This is about the same size as a 16 or 18 ounce bottle of, say, shampoo. You can't rinse these out after you've used them. They're basically sealed and they're going to go to landfill this way, and then they're going to get squished, and any leftover product is then going to run out into the landfill after it's been squished. By comparison, if you use a pump, that's something that you can nicely rinse out. And you should always rinse those out 3 times with a little bit of water for any pump that you know is water-based. Just add some water and use that product like you would normally use it. The downside of pumps is they have a high level of methanol or sometimes ethanol, methyl alcohol or ethyl alcohol in them, and those also make very fine droplets. Those of you who are from California know that methanol and ethanol also add to photochemical smog and the whole issue of air pollution, and that's essentially the replacement for the butane and propane in these. So while the pumps are somewhat better than aerosols like this, they're not a lot better. They are refillable in many cases, though, and you can always use the pump for something else. But try and avoid all forms of aerosol if possible. And lastly, think about the fate of the product. Where is it going to go? The leftovers, are they going to sit in your cupboard for years and years and years and years and not be any good when you get around to using them? Or are you going to have to throw out a bunch? Are you going to end up using a product that could harm rivers and streams? Really give that some consideration at the point of purchase. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the label now. I told you that I have trouble reading labels too, but there are some things that you can get off of a label that are pretty helpful. First of all, don't let labels like natural or organic mislead you. Every chemical that contains carbon is, by definition, an organic chemical. Generally, organic means something to us that was produced without pesticides, But there's nothing in the world that says that that's the only way that the word organic can be used. So people in the ad agencies have misused the word organic repeatedly. Likewise, there are a variety of natural products that are among the most toxic compounds, most toxic chemicals that exist. So just because something is, quote, natural, doesn't mean that it's necessarily good either. There are certainly things that are natural and organic that are good, but those two words don't necessarily give you any guarantee that what you're buying is necessarily safe. Labels are often misleading or incomplete, and as a matter of fact, the new head of the Food and Drug Administration is proposing new regulations on labeling, and those will be coming out within about the next 18 months. We can expect to see some real changes in labeling occurring. But there are some words on labels right now that you need to pay a lot of attention to. Anything that says poison, carcinogen, corrosive, caustic, volatile, flammable, explosive, caution, warning, or danger should give you a hint that you have a toxic chemical. Okay, let's take a look at three of these words, danger, warning, and caution. Danger is the worst in terms of toxicity. That means that the compound is highly toxic and less than one teaspoon is enough to kill a human. Likewise, it could be something that's extremely flammable or something that's corrosive, meaning that it would eat tissue. A perfect example of that would be something like Drano, which of course is lye, or sodium hydroxide in very concentrated form, and is very highly corrosive. That could also be labeled caustic, is the other key word for corrosive. Acids are also called corrosives. Compounds that say warning are moderately toxic, meaning a teaspoon to a tablespoon could be lethal. And caution is lower toxicity, meaning on the order of a tablespoon to a cup could be lethal. So those are kind of rules of thumb. So anything that says caution has the lowest toxicity, danger has the highest toxicity.
Do you have any examples of any of those?
Yeah.
Of product?
Many pesticides will say danger or warning, depending on the pesticide. More and more pesticides are being taken off the shelves in terms of home application, and commercial applicators can apply them, trained commercial applicators. And many of those pesticides that are at concentrations where the trained commercial applicators would apply them would be labeled danger in the concentrated form. A perfect example would be something like malathion at 5% or parathion at a 1% concentration. Two fairly toxic organophosphate insecticides. When you dilute out malathion to a much lower concentration, like what was used on the medflies in California, you begin to get down into the warning level. I'm pretty sure Drano is labeled as danger. Anybody think
about Weed Be Gone?
Yeah, navel jelly, Weed Be Gone. Yeah, Weed Be Gone is another one that you can buy in various concentrations, from very concentrated to relatively dilute in the little spray cans. But yeah, I think most of those are labeled danger. Many pesticides are. Navel jelly is phosphoric acid in a jelly form, and it's extremely corrosive. Oh, another good one is oxalic acid, which is used a lot for teak bleach on wood, or fiberglass cleaner. I happen to be a boater, and it's a lot easier to get your teak clean if you use oxalic acid. And environmentally, oxalic acid is pretty benign once it's diluted out. But you buy it as a solid powder, and then you mix it up in solution, and that stuff is nasty, really nasty. Other ideas?
Roundup, I was wondering.
Roundup is glyphosate, is the chemical name for the Roundup is 2,4-D.
Yeah. No. 2,4-D works in the soil.
Right.
Systemic works in the plant.
Right, right. I'll take a look. I always get those two names confused. 2,4-D and glyphosate. 2,4-D is by far the worst, but I can never remember brand names, whether Weed Gone and Roundup, which is which. The Cleanup and Roundup are the same, different brands.
How about Lysol and ammonia?
Ammonia almost certainly is labeled danger. It doesn't take much ammonia inhaled to do very serious lung damage. Lysol is another one. I heard a horrible story about Lysol. You know, Lysol has alcohol to dilute it. And one of my friends happens to be working on an Indian reservation this summer as a volunteer in the medical center. And since Lysol has alcohol in it, Native American drank it and promptly died. So there are Lysol poisoning cases that still go on today, and that happened about a month ago. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. In terms of a safe cleaning kit, these are some materials that make great additions to a safe cleaning kit. Baking soda, for example, is wonderful for getting off cooked on food. And any of you who've been around your grandmothers know this. I learned it from my grandmother when she saw me scrubbing away on a pot. Poured the baking soda on and let it sit overnight, and boy, the next day it came off nice and easily. Likewise, liquid soap. Borax is great for cockroaches, for instance, or ants. There's some debate as to how it kills cockroaches. Some people have told me it desiccates them. Some people have told me they like it, think it tastes good, and eat it, and it poisons them. And some people have told me that they rub their little legs together and the crystals grind holes in their legs and they die. Anyway, it kills them quite effectively. And when you use borax, what you need to do is put it in the cracks around where pests would come in. Not little piles, but rather any place there's a crack. The U.S. Army is using borax for cockroach control at all the Army bases today rather than more toxic pesticides. Yeah.
But borax is a crystal boric acid.
Yes. Fine crystals.
You don't mean the borax that you use on diapers?
It's not a brand name borax, but a chemical borax.
The chemical borax. It's really the same chemical. It's just in a different granular form. You just want the fine stuff where it can get down in cracks. Salt, of course, vinegar, lemon juice, non-chlorinated scouring powder. Don't mind mentioning brand names, but Bonami happens to be a non-chlorinated scouring powder that really does the trick.
It's impossible to find in stores too.
No, it's coming back. It's coming back. Enough of the state organizations that are interested in household toxics have pushed it enough that now you can almost always find it in the stores. And of course, the reason you want to avoid chlorinated scouring powder is because when it bleaches, what it's doing is chemically reacting with the molecules in the stains, as well as the molecules that are going down the drain, and you make chlorinated organics in the process of the materials leaving your drain. Yeah.
I would like to go back to liquid soap. Now, are you specifying, is that ivory or Lux or Palmolive or woodland, any?
Yeah, any of those would be perfectly reasonable versus synthetic detergents. I'm not a great one for a lot of the, quote, natural schemes. The ones that use cucumber rinds and yogurt for everything. But there are some good books being published, and I'm going to mention a few of them at the end. But various states, such as the state of Washington, have actually put out some nice little booklets. This one's called Turning the Tide on Toxics in the Home, A Guide to Safer Alternatives and Proper Disposal, and actually goes through explaining, for instance, what you might use for a paint and then what you might use as a safer alternative. And also, this list of suggested materials for your safe cleaning kit, you can get a guide, and I can show you one later on, that actually lists a whole bunch of uses for these various materials in the safe cleaning kit. For instance, vegetable oil is great for getting off black marks, scuffs that you might have on your floor. They'll come right up with a little vegetable oil, a little scouring.
Liquid soap, like any kind of liquid soap as opposed to dry washing soap or bar soap? Or
One of the reasons liquid soap, oh, bar soap is fine.
Oh.
One of the reasons that liquid soap is a nice alternative is liquid soap is always non-phosphate. And most dry soaps still have some phosphates, most dry detergents still have some phosphates in them, although some are getting pretty low. But, you know, Tide has finally come out with a dry soap version that's no phosphate. But most of the dry detergents still have phosphate in them. It's dropped over the years, but it's still on the order of 4 or 5%. I'm just going to slap this up here right now for a second, and we can come back to this later on in discussion. Some of the things people get concerned about include, what do you do about fleas on your dog, lawn care chemicals, aphids, moths that might be in your clothes, insect garden pests, et cetera, et cetera. And this happens to be just a list of some of the pamphlets that the Washington Toxics Coalition has put out. And I brought a complete set of them along, and I'm going to leave them in the reading room so you can take a look at them. We can buy an entire set of them for about $5. And they're about anywhere from 4 to 16 pages each, where people have really put a lot of thought into what you can do. And like I said, we can come back and talk about these in just a second. Now, if you can't use a safer alternative, and you really have to use a hazardous substance, first of all, follow the label. You'd be amazed at how many people, when they use pesticides, say, if the label says a tablespoon, I'll use a cup. The various county extension agents around the country did a study not long ago that compared commercial applicators of pesticides with home applicators of pesticides and found that commercial applicators followed the directions roughly 95% of the time. By a lot, it's supposed to be 100%. They did pretty good. By comparison, home applicators fell down somewhere under 50% in following the directions on pesticide applications. So saying that you should follow the label is not a trivial point. I never mix products. Of course, the best example of inappropriate mixing of products is mixing any kind of chlorine bleaching agent with ammonia, because you produce chloramine, a very toxic gas, which was used as a chemical warfare agent during World War I. Of course, when I was a kid, my mother told me not to do that. I promptly did it and didn't kill myself, but it's a real dumb thing to do. There are a lot of other chemical products that react with each other to produce things like chloramine, phosgene, or other gases. Whenever possible, choose a material that will allow you to limit your personal exposure to the chemical or the environment, your family or the environment's exposure to the chemical. For instance, there are a lot of new products being developed, including things like solvent-free adhesives. And this is a big deal in the adhesive industry. So you make a glue that doesn't work by having solvent evaporate. Rather, there's no solvent there, and that's why you use so little of some of the modern glues, because there's no solvent. And of course, water-based formulations. And likewise, lots of industries are going to water-based formulations as much as possible. Again, so there aren't solvents present. Where appropriate protection? If you worked for Boeing and you were painting airplane wings, you would be wearing chemically resistant gloves, you'd have on a respirator, and you'd probably have on some kind of shock coat or apron. You need to have these same kinds of pieces of equipment around the home. Chemically resistant gloves you can buy at the hardware store. Read them to be sure that they say they are chemical resistant, not just dishwashing gloves. Particle masks, the little 3M paper masks, are only good for big particles. They don't filter out gases at all. For gases, you really need a respirator. As a chemist at PLU, I get a lot of weird calls. And you can kind of tell how good you are in with the secretary by how weird the calls are that get passed on. Don't want to be alive, don't wear a respirator. We keep a respirator around the house. You can buy them at any hardware store today. Make sure you're buying a respirator for the purpose that you're intending to use it for. And if you're working with paints, it's a real good idea. Solvent-based paints, it's a real good idea to wear one. Likewise, protective clothing. Again, have good ventilation. And you know, lots of people who do dumb things in closed garages and don't live to see the next day. Most people do live to see the next day, but you're inhaling those vapors and it's certainly not good for your lungs, your liver, your kidneys, etc. And of course, lastly, use common sense, which some of us sometimes don't do. Hobbies are an interesting area because lots of us have hobbies that really use a fair number of types of toxic chemicals. Probably the worst is artists. Many oil-based pigments in the past have included large amounts of lead, cadmium, chromium. You all have heard of cadmium yellow, cadmium orange, chromium salts that are orange or green, etc. Most of those pigments are now being produced so that they're free of these toxic metals, but there's still a lot of paints around that have them. Likewise, artists tend to use large amounts of solvents, and in the case of making paper, etching glass, etc., can use some pretty nasty acids. In the case of auto repair, some people wash parts in gasoline. It's a real bad idea because even today, gasoline contains up to 5% benzene. Benzene causes leukemia. It's one of the chemicals where there is a very strong positive correlation between human leukemia and exposure to benzene. So if you're doing auto repair and you need to degrease parts, use something like Stoddard solvent, which is a commercial solvent that you can buy rather than gasoline. Furniture finishers, of course, use a lot of strippers, etc. There's a new stripper out that hardens and you peel off. Have any of you used it? I haven't tried it yet. I've seen it, but I haven't had anything to strip since it came on the market. But basically, you paint it on, and it reacts with the paint, and then you just peel the material off, and it's a solid. I'm kind of intrigued by using that the next time I have to strip something. But sandpaper works pretty well in many applications. if you have to use a stripper, try and avoid the ones that contain methylene chloride. Many of them contain methylene chloride, particularly the really good hot ones. By hot, I mean will dissolve anything. A perfect example of a stripper that's dynamite for getting paint or varnish off, but it's full of methylene chloride, is Sears stripper. The ones with methyl ethyl ketone, or MEK, aren't quite as hot, don't strip paint off quite as well, but they're substantially less threatening to your liver and kidneys. Yeah?
I went to OSHA with manufacturing client and went through the whole bit of methylene chloride because they were setting up shop in the U.S. and didn't want to cause any environmental problems or complaints about employees. And there was quite a bit of back and forth on just what the danger is of methylene chloride. Is it there? Isn't it? Is it documented? Is it contradicted? It's brilliant stuff. But it didn't, the case against it didn't seem to be conclusive. Now, OSHA wasn't going to say that. But I was standing in the middle, and I wasn't convinced either way.
Methylene chloride is very, very widely used in industry today. But there are several reasons why the use is dropping. First of all, carbon tetrachloride, this compound, carbon surrounded by four fluorines. Chloroform is this compound, and methylene chloride is this chloroform compound. Chloroform and carbon tetrachloride are both essentially banned for most common use. Carbon tet got banned first, then followed by chloroform. Methylene chloride was then the preferred substitute. If you look at the chemical reactions, which I'm not going to, this is definitely worse in terms of giving you problems with your liver, but at high exposures, that's not far behind. So it's a matter of what the level of exposure is. Yeah, right. So in an industry, if it were well ventilated and well controlled, they're going to use it. We use it around the lab in fume hoods. But when it gets used for paint stripping around the home in the garage, it's a real different story. So it's kind of an order of degree. But, you know, I used to use it at home, and I don't anymore. And for woodworkers, dust masks are really a good idea. Sawdust, particularly fine sawdust, like you'd get from a mechanical sander, is again small enough that some of those particles can end up in the lungs.
Is that with the 3M masks?
Yeah, the 3M masks are pretty. Yeah, right.
Question about French air refreshers.
Yeah.
I bought some strippers in the past, and I'd like to get rid of them. I haven't used them. Now that I know the toxic, I guess I didn't realize the toxicity, and I don't want to have it around. What's the effective way of getting rid of that?
It's in the can.
Look for a household hazardous waste pickup day in your area. Where are you from?
Northern California.
They probably have one in your county. And it probably happens once a year, and for some reason everybody seems to do them in the fall and in the spring. I know in Tacoma we happen to have ours in the fall. If you want to get, say you're moving or something like that, you want to get rid of some hazardous waste in fairly short order, call your local health department and ask them what to do with them. Our local health department will take them if someone says, look, I'm moving, and if you don't take it, it's going to go to landfill, and they'll say, okay, bring it by. In the county next to ours, Thurston County, they actually have what they call a hazo house at the dump. And it's right on the way into the dump, and you can just stop and drop your stuff off at the hazo house. In the city of Tacoma, at the landfill, they have a site where they'll take hazardous waste from people who live in the city of Tacoma. They won't take them from out-of-town people, and I'll get to that reason in just a second. But um, Yeah, generally a drop-off day will happen in your area. If not, bug your county health department because they ought to be doing it. If that doesn't work, the next best thing is to call some of the chemical companies in your area, and they may well take it. In Seattle, Chempro, which is a major chemical recycler and takes chemicals off to the hazardous waste landfill, will take anything that a citizen drops off. They do it as a public service.
What do you suggest? My wife and I have been cleaning our house upstairs. We've got this sort of popcorn ceiling, and you've got, you know, you try to put a coat of paint on there. You can wear a mask, try to wear some glasses. If you wear glasses, you can't see it. You know, I mean, you wear, and even with the mask, I had trouble with my throat for a day or two after I finished painting, because I know the paint was coming down, you know, and I was breathing that stuff.
But I
didn't try the respirator. I just bought these little bitty.
Yeah.
And that, I guess it was better than nothing, but I really didn't feel it was that effective either.
Yeah, they're not. They're not. They're basically designed for large particles. You know, Mount St. Helens ash, sawdust, that kind of thing. What I suggest is considering a water-based paint and spraying it with a respirator, so you're not knocking as much stuff down. And basically, glue it in place. All over the country, people are trying to figure out how much people know about household chemicals and what you ought to do with them. And this data is pretty much backed up various places, but this was some data done in Pierce County for our household hazardous waste planning process. This was done a year, actually it was part of the 1989 Quality of Life Survey, and it was published last year. About 5% of all people are well informed on what to do, somewhere around 40% are somewhat informed, and somewhere over 50% still don't really have a good idea. If you look at what people do with a couple of kinds of materials, waste oil is a good example. This other does include a lot of proper disposal, by the way. But if we look at waste oil disposal, of course, a bunch of people don't change their own oil, so it was irrelevant, or they didn't have cars. About 7% didn't know what they do with waste oil. About 12% put it in the garbage can. Not a good idea. Fortunately, 0% poured it in the sink, but about 6% spread it on the ground. Also, not a good idea. Of this 67%, most of those either had their oil changed at the gas station or did indeed take it to a recycling point. Some states require, mandate, oil recycling, and everybody who sells oil is supposed to tell you where to get rid of it. Unfortunately, you'll find that many of the places have lost their sign or forgot to put it up or don't know where to get rid of it. Our recycling centers in the state of Washington take it right now, but you have to pay a little bit. Most cities and counties will take it as long as they know it's not contaminated. For instance, our city shops will happily take it, and then they recycle it. They send it out, and it's recycled into new oil. Most of the waste oil, by the way, either gets recycled into new oil or goes into bunker fuel and gets burned on ships. Antifreeze is another material that people commonly use, and of course 9% don't know what they do with it, 16% put it in the garbage can, not a good idea, 2% pour it down the sink, 7% spread it on the ground. and 44% use other ways of disposing of it. Anybody here know the best way to get rid of antifreeze? Anybody ever gotten rid of antifreeze? Well, first of all, don't let your dog drink it. It tastes good to dogs because it tastes sweet and it's highly toxic. So that's not a good idea to spread it on the ground. Anybody have any ideas? Well, actually, if you live on a sewer, pouring it down the drain isn't all that bad a thing to do with it. But the best thing to do with it is to recycle it. And in the state of Washington, state of California, and I believe state of Oregon, there's now mandatory antifreeze recycling by all of the service stations who change antifreeze in cars. And many, many shops are now buying their own antifreeze recycling units, or their companies that will come in and take it away and reprocess it and reuse it. So just like with oil, antifreeze is another material that can be completely reprocessed into perfectly good new ethylene glycol and reused in your car. Okay, so what shows up at the collection days? These happen to be two collection days, two different years. The biggest quantity, paint and solvents, both years. Leftover paints I mentioned earlier on, and things like the strippers that you mentioned. They get in hobby supplies, pool chemicals, lab chemicals, various kinds of spray cans, cleaners, pesticides, and then just a whole range of who knows what, from mercury to batteries to you name it. It may well come in. And notice that from 87 to 88, the amount of other began to drop off, as did the amount of hobby supplies. And that's pretty common. People have this stuff sitting around. Somebody does their first collection day, all the weird stuff comes in, and then in future collection days, there's not quite so much weird stuff coming in. Now, what happens to this stuff? Well, some of it gets recycled. In the city of Seattle city of Minneapolis, they took the oil-based paints and mixed them all together and made some new paint. And a paint company tested it out in both cities, and it was just fine. And so they used it around the city shops and city applications. They just plain used it. Generally, the volunteers they get for these days are chemists and home hobbyists and stuff, and most people will take some of the stuff home and maybe use it or maybe bring it back the next year. Any other products that are usable, these folks try to use, because the alternative is either a lab pack or that the liquids are combined in a barrel or bulked. What a lab pack is a barrel packed with vermiculite that they then pack the jars or bottles into, seal it up, and ship it to a hazardous waste disposal site, such as the one at Arlington, Oregon, which is where the waste from Oregon, Washington, and Idaho go. This was the 1989 Pierce County Collection Day, and they had a total of 56 lab packs. To send a lab pack to Arlington, Oregon, cost $550. So multiply 550 times 56, and you begin to get some idea of just the fundamental cost of doing one of these kinds of collection days. And of course, you can guess that you and I, the taxpayers, are paying for that through city or county budgets, whoever is doing it. With the bulk liquids, it's not quite so bad because, like some of these solvents, and of course the antifreeze, and like I mentioned, paints, can get reused and may well get recycled or reused. But their total was 90 barrels of material. 750 gallons of waste oil and 25 car batteries, and that was with 575 cars coming to drop materials off. This is pretty typical of what happens in a county of a couple hundred thousand when they hold one of these collection days. First year they held one in the city of Seattle, they had over 2,000 cars show up. It was quite the event.